course, I think that I need not say with great underlinings that the Kanawha people will probably be forced to move inland. They're people of the river. I have many Kanawha friends, and I call them the High Seas Indians as a kind of private joke. Perhaps in 10 or 15 years, if there are not policy on Washington level, the Kanawha, my joke will fall on deaf ears, or it'll cause sadness. In Alaska today, near the pole, the Interior Department again, the White House, and the top 8 oil firms in the world, forming the Alaska Consortium, will begin, they did begin last week, the construction of the most massive digging project on the face of the earth, the construction of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, comparable to the carving of the Suez Canal in the 1800s, and by the end of the 1970s, with minimal gain, Eskimo oil will be piped down to southeast Alaska, brought by oil transport to the city of Seattle, perhaps carried around the South American Cape, or perhaps carried across the U.S. to heat your homes in Philadelphia. So I mentioned first a negative force which weighs upon Indian people today, a state of siege manifested as a subtler and infinitely more complex, infinitely more politically complex war over the resources, lands, water, and timber of the Indian people. Secondly, a negative factor which weighs very heavily on the soul of the Indian man and the Indian woman is a very much documentable worsening of the interracial atmosphere countrywide between Indian and non-Indian people. There appears to me to be a locking of the doors of mutual perceptions of people to people. Dollars for the surrender of natural resource rights across that state, which numbers nearly 300 million square acres, and entitled them to only about 1/10 of their historic native lands in our largest state. Following the pumping of some monies into Native Alaska, which numbers about 70,000 Native peoples, and the creation of 12 Native corporations, we have a massive anti-Native backlash taking place in Alaska today. There are threats received at the offices of elected and traditional Native leaders, threats of assassination, which are received on the rate of 2 or 3 a week. We are tolerating this if we do not do something about it. If we do not do something about it, perhaps we are guilty of this ourselves. In New Mexico last week, the bodies of 3 Navajo men were found partially beheaded, burned. 2 of the 3 bodies were stripped, and the various private and more common members of the organs of the body crushed. About 4 days ago, 3 white teenagers in the small town of Farmington, New Mexico, just on the periphery of the Navajo reservation, apparently provided confessions for those 3 murders of these older Navajo men and for similar murders of 3 Navajo men, which took place in May of 1973. This week, Navajos are marching in the streets of Gallup, in the streets of Farmington, New Mexico. They will march next weekend in Albuquerque, and the following week they will be marching in Santa Fe. Navajo people, unlike many of the other tribes, have not had this aggressive posture that perhaps one sees in the American Indian movement. Navajo Chairman Peter McDonald is a friend of mine, and he is a strong critic of the American Indian movement. He told me one day about 4 months ago, "We're not like the Sioux. We don't try the route of crazy horse. We put ourselves to death. All the way." We succeed. Begins a very steep ascent. And I think, and I have to add, for myself as a journalist, I expect to be assigned to the Southwest in some of our fall. Basis out of the continued brutality of people and the new aggressive political posture, especially of the younger Navajo people. of the second negative force working very strongly in Indian life and worsening in the 1970s, which is a worsening of the interracial climate among Indians and non-Indian people. The third debilitating factor working against many Indian people, I would like to be very candid about this evening, with the risk of offending some of my Indian cousins who are in this room. It is my private judgment, and this is only a private judgment, that Indian people coming out of a traumatic experience of 3 to 4 centuries of invasion and displacement today experience a kind of neurosis coming out of our history. It is said of the feminist movement today that to find a woman is to find a neurotic. I have looked into the eyes of many Indian people of all ages. I find a particular kind of pain that I see in the eyes of Indian men and Indian women. I see a certain kind of capacity to understand horrors which people simply out of kindness and good graces do not talk about. I think Indian people have a larger tragic sense than anyone else in America. Perhaps we are also in our spirits a little bit ill. Perhaps we're a little bit off-center, like creatures and communities ricocheted out of the common experience of America. And today we have perhaps even a partial collective state of unhealth, which comes out of our experience of being displaced and uprooted and discriminated against, even until the second week of May in 1974 and continuing. There is, on the part of a number of Indians, one way to respond to what I define as a working definition of Indian neurosis. I think that as you have more and more Indian people around the country finding themselves more and more in a state of despair, then you have people who are simply, and if I might put it this way, willing to tear down the whole goddamn house. If there is, in the minds of enough Indian people, not enough room to be home in a homeland, then I think on the part of those Indian people who think that way, we're going to have a very hectic decade. Events such as the slaying of Raymond Yellow Thunder in March of 1972 in South Dakota, which I covered for a period of several weeks, followed by events of the Trail of Broken Treaties and the seizure of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, followed by hassles in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, and thereby in Gary, Nebraska, a dust-up in Custer, South Dakota, all of these things preceding Wounded Knee. History has its own directions. Perhaps other directions will result in 1974, and I have no doubt, as an adult and as a journalist, that we may see other such manifestations. Perhaps a kind of expressed symbolic rage of despair on the part of a significant number of Indian people. Unlike many other Indians around the country, I don't damn or condemn or turn my back on this kind of manifestation, because my first responsibility as an Indian man who lives in this time is to attempt to comprehend it and to attempt to gauge its results. These, then, are some of the negative forces that I have seen looking around America, and particularly looking around Indian America in my time. I look at the unseen American, the American Indian, in this fashion. Beginning in the West, I see the large number of Native American reservations, the continuing survival of tribal people on tribal land, as the most magnificent, flowering, invisible island societies in America. To me, the reservations and the intact, integral, fully flourishing tribal societies of the West are like bright stars in the night, like beautiful leaves floating in a very troubled and muddy pool of water. Working toward the East, because the experience of Indian people in the East has been longer and of much more travail in the East, I see a kind of separate intermeshing of more and more indivisible but very real Indian societies floating in a somewhat hazier but in no less a real fashion here in the East. The process of the collision, the process of impact, the process of ricochet of Indian people and the Indian spirit is very vast, and very problematic here in the East, but one which we in the West have to and must deal with on a par, because we are the inheritors of the original peoples in this country, and to the extent that Indian people still live today, it comes down to about 800 of us, and that's all. And we can take censuses, and we know who we are, and that's you and us and we. On the affirmative side, I would like to define some things which I think are some of the most significant things I'm able to detect happening among the whole national community of Indian people in this time. First, I see a manifestation, an effort, a direction occurring among Indian people, which I do not think will come to fruition within 40 years, or perhaps about 40 years. And that is this, that Indian people are wresting back the whole scope of human institutions from non-Indian control. By this I mean that there are movements afoot throughout Indian life, throughout the Indian universe, across Indian country today, to take the control of that Indian teachers and Indian parents can have the proper beneficial input into the shaping of the young Indian soul and the young Indian identity. This is a major manifestation of the resting back of the institution of education into Indian hands. There is a process of attrition from the Christian churches widespread among Indian people. In the Navajo Nation, which is the largest of the Indian nations in America, numbering nearly 140,000 people, there is today only about 2% of that tribe which is Christian again. There is a massive and near total resurrection of the tribal traditional Navajo visions, and a resurrection of the respect of Navajo medicine men. And something very important is afoot at Navajo. Where it will go, we will not know immediately. There are other benign efforts that take over. There are drives to institute the employment of Indian social workers countrywide in both urban and reservation communities and rural communities. There are efforts to train Indian teachers. There are efforts to train Indian journalists. There are efforts to train Indians in practically every capacity in which a community can be served. And I think that probably if we have to say there is a direction, if there is a direction to Indian time today, into the saga of Indian history today, it is that the forces of control over Indian life are moving from outside the circle back toward the center of the circle in Indian hands. The second major affirmative force that I see working within the Indian world is the return of Indian people to a psychic center. And I might use a private example. My tribe, the Yakima tribe in eastern Washington state, numbers around 7,000 people. Like myself, there are numbers of people who, in their adult years, are working elsewhere and who have the option of visiting maybe 3 or 4 weeks out of a 52-week year, visiting with friends, getting back to singing, and the like. But there is what I call a centripetal force, a force of seeking the center in terms of the human relationships of Indian people, which is very unlike that which prevailed among Indian people only 20 years ago. That process 20 years ago was a process of spinning away from the center, finding the cities, many Indians going to Europe. There are Indians today who work in the State Department. There are Indians of the generation, the ages of 40s and 50s, who work in the military installations across the country. And we have people who have broken their umbilical ties and cords to their home communities. I like to say that despite Thomas Wolfe, American Indian people in this country are the only people who can truly go home again and again and again. Thirdly, I think that a major affirmative force at work among Indians, which is a secular non-Indian success, but one which is of course critical to Indian people today, is that there is a widespread commitment to set Indian items on the public agenda of America with increased political sophistication. I think that what I just said is probably would not be accepted by a large number of people. But I would like to line up some instances. This autumn, we will have two Navy people running for the United States Congress, and I think that their candidacies pose this question best. American Indians have a dual citizenship. First, the citizenship in their own tribes, and since 1924, under public law, citizenship in the United States of America. Many Indian people find it unwanted and unwelcome that other Indians would seek to involve themselves in a totally plugged-in fashion with the processes of the larger American society. But it's my belief in meeting younger Indians between the ages of about 18 to 40 that the drift of this generation is that it's necessary to understand how Congress works, it's necessary to understand what makes state houses spin, it's necessary to find out what makes poverty programs work so that the human needs of Indian people are met. And I think that this is a tone of increasing political sophistication, which, as Mr. Cadwallader said, is one instance of Indian people assuring you that they know how to run their lives best. I think overall, despite the brief review of some of the current and ongoing tragedies that Indian people experience, what I see right now, which defines the decade of the 1970s, the late 60s and the 1970s, from other parts of our own Indian history in the 20th century, is that we have a firmer and firmer and firmer rekindling of a sense of our Indian selves. Last week I saw a singer which many of you may know, a Cree woman of 32 years of age named Buffy St. Marie. She closed her show, by the way, if you've seen Buffy, have many of you seen Buffy perform? She lately has been mixing something like Blood, Sweat, and Tears, big band rock with their traditional music. And I had never seen her before, and I wanted to see this Indian woman perform. And the way she sang one song, which really wasn't an Indian song, but she turned it into an Indian song by the way she sang it. She said, "I have my own loves. I have my own dooms. I have my own sins. I have my own burden of time, and I'll work it out." Thank you.